Welcome to the Avery Ventures Podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Avery.
And I'm Tanya Avery.
We're down in Boise. We're at the home of the infamous Darren Cooper. Welcome to the show, Darren, for the second time.
Yeah, thanks. Good to be back on.
If you don't know who Darren is, Darren worked for a long time for Hoyt. He helped design the
cam and a half system. Kinds of stuff.
At Hoyt, he's a dyed-in-the-wool bow hunter that's kind of switched gears as of late and moved on to a little bit of the competition rifle shooting, PRS, NRL kind of thing.
And he was with us at Rockslide.
Yep, and you were with Rockslide for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
Before Chris Denham stole you.
That was good times.
So what has been the change over from, I know you're still a bow hunter at heart, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
What made you decide, oh, I'm going to start shooting competition rifle side?
I've always been interested and intrigued by long-range rifles and just never really had time when I was competing on the archery side to really get into it and do it justice. So I was just kind of left that on the back burner. And then when Idaho opened the wolf season, that's when I knew it was time to, you know, dig in.
Right.
And so I started getting back into rifles and, you know, I grew up rifle hunting as a kid, but as soon as I started bow hunting, that turned my crank a lot more, so I really enjoyed the bow hunting, but I knew that killing a wolf with a bow was probably slim odds, so
right.
I wanted to just dig into the rifle thing, and I've always been intrigued by precision anything, you know, rifle, archery, whatever. I just love the pursuit of accuracy.
Right.
And so jumped into to long-range shooting. And learned pretty quick that as, you know, as skillful as I was with a bow, I wasn't with a rifle. And so I realized from my experience in archery that, you know, I gravitated toward competitive archery because I knew that was the fastest way to learn. It was always also the easiest way to mix in with the guys that really knew their shit and that I could learn from the fastest. And when you're thrown into that situation where you're competing, there's something there's in that process that really drives you to get better fast. And so I knew that was kind of the ticket for, you know, getting good at guns.
Right.
You know, so I jumped into that, and it's been a blast. I've learned a shitload, and yeah, it's been awesome. Met some great people and worked with some really cool companies, and just yeah, it's like my archery career all over again. So it's been just kind of fun to, you know, relight some fires that I don't know. It's been cool.
Is there similarities from the comp archery side to the comp rifle shooting side?
Absolutely. And I think that's more than anything allowed me to make that transition really quickly and be fairly competitive, because just kind of a lot of the mental processes of, you know, approaching a stage at a PRS shoot is not all that different than, you know, approaching a target at a big archery tournament or whatever. You have to have the right kind of mental program built in and get your nerves under control and just go execute, you know, your plan.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's really helped me. And I've really never experienced nerves in rifle shooting because I've done it so much in archery and I think a lot of guys get amped up. I mean, at some level I get, you know, excited and I come out of a stage, maybe out of breath or whatever, you know, amped up, but it's not like I'm really nervous going into it because, I don't have as much of expectations, you know, especially being kind of new in the sport. So right. if I do anything above suck, you know, it feels pretty good.
Right.
Whereas if I go to an archery shoot and I do anything but awesome, you know, it's a downer. So, it's been a lot of fun to just kind of start over with something from scratch. But even though it's so similar, it's given me just kind of some inroads and made it easier to get in there and do well.
Is there anything that you could tell somebody that since you really just got started, what, 2 years ago on the comp side?
Yeah, about 2 years. Not even quite 2 years yet.
But. Is there anything in that 2 years to kind of learning curve-wise you could tell somebody that's just getting started?
Wow.
I'm not talking like weight sorting brass plates and time shit.
Geez. Just start. I mean, that's the biggest thing. It's just get, even if you don't have a hot rod rifle or anything, just get out there and start, because everybody that's at those shoots that knows more than you is going to contribute to your education, and they're more than happy to loan you gear, give you advice, teach you how to approach stages. So every shoot that you skip by thinking that you're not ready, you're sacrificing an opportunity to learn. Mm-hmm. And so I would say, stop kicking the can down the road and start. Just go to one. Even if you don't take your rifle, go to one and start asking questions and learn from people, because that's how you start the process.
Yeah. Just like hunting. I mean, if you fixate on having all the perfect gear, you're never going to start. You just got to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Go. If you it's like trying to tackle your first elk hunt. You can think about it for 5 years and think you're going to be prepared.
Research.
You're still going to show up and not know what the hell you're doing. Mm-hmm. But you'll learn more in your first season of trying an elk hunt out of state than you will in 10 years of trying to research it.
You Absolutely. Know?
There's nothing that beats experience. And I think just the crowd that goes to those shoots, it's a ton of great people. And you know, you don't have to be intimidated. You know, there's almost always going to be somebody there that's going to be better than you. And there's always going to be somebody there that's worse than you. And nobody's judging.
Right.
Nobody's judging. Life. You know, that's the same situation.
Nobody cares. You know, if you go in there and don't hit a shot, you know, people are going to be like, damn, I wish you'd have done better. But you're going to learn a ton in the process, and nobody's going to think less of you.
Right. Well, everyone's probably worried more about how they're doing than how you're doing.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't really pay attention to how other guys are shooting. Right. You know, I'm always watching the top guys trying to learn stuff when I'm at those shoots, but If you're a first time guy and you know, I spot something, you know, I'm going to let you know, or say, hey, why don't you try this, or offer you a piece of gear, or, you know, whatever the case may be. But nobody's there to judge you and you know, make fun of you or anything like that. It's all good.
How has I see your trophy for the NRL for the 22 league.
Yeah.
Does that help you become a better, actually, the center fire side?
Absolutely, because the structure of the shoots is almost identical, and it's so much cheaper to go out and shoot your 22, and you don't have to put in all the effort to reloading.
Right.
And I just, it's something just super fun about, you know, going and just plinking with the 22. They're inherently so accurate that it comes down to just your execution of the shot.
Right. And you can almost see what you're doing wrong when you break that trigger. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a great way to get not only new, like, men shooters in, but it's a great way to get women and smaller
women and kids into. Yeah. NRL does a really good job of promoting the junior, or I can't remember what they call them, and the, you know, but the kids. And, it's been really fun to shoot with some of those kids and watch them to grow and develop over the course of a season. It's pretty amazing how well some of these kids pick it up and get competitive.
It's crazy. Impressive. We met a bunch of kids in Dallas at the NRA thing that are doing the competitive shooting, and I was shocked. I didn't have any idea that they were – one so many, like, such a big interest in that age group. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's impressive. I mean, just watching such young kids be able to get on stuff. And
yeah, a few times I've been out, I don't know if you know Matt Soa.
He does, I don't think so.
Soa Strong Industries. He's does Cerakoting. Mm-hmm. Anyways, he has a son named Trigg, and he's taken him out, and I've been several different shoots with him, like stage 6-8 months apart, and this kids are like a sponge.
Yeah, no, they pick it up and they're having a blast, and it's just it's fun to see parents and their kids interacting and just, you know, everybody having fun and kids just getting, you know, geeked out on guns
It is.
He having actually, fun and, you know, learn to use them safe. And I think all that stuff trickles down to, you know, their friends. And they're like, oh, you know, guns aren't bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I mean, learn
to use them safe. And it's good for the sport.
Yeah. That's mm-hmm. what I'm going to say. Any way to grow it. And Trigg was already taller than Frank. They shot together in the sniper title. He was about 2 inches taller than Frank Galley. You know, awesome. Frank, obviously. Yeah,
it's kind of a bummer. I wish that would have been bigger where we are when our kids were, you know, younger, because I think that they would have, our son definitely would have really enjoyed that.
Oh, yeah. No, I wish it would have been around when my daughter was a little bit younger, too, because, you know, any excuse to take them shooting. And, you know, they set it up so that it's really fun and engaging, and all the stages are, you know, mm-hmm. they're different every week, and it's a new challenge, and you know, it teaches you how to approach stuff in hunting situations, mm-hmm. for sure.
Yeah, and it seems like the ones that I've been to, which hasn't been a lot, they kind of cater, and those kids get something, they win something.
Yeah.
So it kind of reinforces, hey, I'm just not out here to shoot for fun. I'm actually winning something, and you know, I'm part of something bigger, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another thing that's cool about a lot of those shoots is. You don't necessarily have to shoot great to come away with some nice prizes, mm-hmm. you know, and there's like the NRL and PRS, they have regional, you know, matches and leagues and stuff too that don't cost as much to enter, and there's still good prizes and stuff. And a lot of times they raffle cool stuff off that doesn't matter where you place, but you know, you can walk out of there with some nice stuff. So
it seems like companies too are, I don't want to say more generous, but more willing to donate to these competitions that have, you know, getting the younger age demographic involved, you know, the younger generation. And so that's really cool to see, and nice to pay attention to when you're putting your money back into the industry, like what companies to be looking at is the ones that give back to the actual, you know,
it's good business. Crowd. Yeah. It's good business. You know, they're forward looking and realizing that, you know, that's their big consumer down mm-hmm. the road. If they can get Absolutely. A kid hooked now on shooting that, you know, loves the sport and get him involved in hunting and shooting and stuff, that's money well spent,
Absolutely.
You know, up front. So,
yeah,
it's cool to see that. And I've seen that, especially with the NRL. They definitely, you know, shift a good chunk of the prize stuff down to the kids, and it's fun to watch them,
yeah.
you know, walk away with some stuff. And they're like, Dad, should I get the, you know, this suppressor or, you know, this awesome free barrel or, you know,
right.
what, you know, what should I do, Dad? And they're yeah. like, hey, you pick, kid. What do you want?
Whatever you want.
Suppressor. Sweet. Fill out your tax chip, kid. That's awesome.
Yeah, it is cool because, you know, I mean, everybody likes to win stuff, but a lot of these grown men don't really need some of these things. I mean, they have the money to buy it if they wanted it, and they've already got their gear mostly dialed in, so to, you know, be able to give those kind of prizes to young kids that wouldn't be able to afford that on their own or wouldn't get that right. bought for them is really fun to see them like light up like they're yeah. on, you know, Christmas Day.
Yeah, it's cool.
Any way we can get more young hunters, young shooters.
Well, that involved. Competition that you went to that Caleb hosts,
Sportsman's Challenge.
The Sportsman's Challenge, just seeing those kids' names getting announced, the winners, that like they just were like on cloud nine. It was so fun just to see the expressions on their face.
Yeah, it is fun.
Article wise, do you have anything gun coming out, gun related?
I'm not working on anything at the moment, but I'm sure in the coming year that I will be. I just finished up a article on the BDX system.
How did you like that?
I think it's pretty cool, you know. I think it's an awesome system for the average hunter. And I don't mean, I'm not talking down to the average hunter, but the guy that doesn't want to get into kind of the finer points of ballistics and all that stuff, that doesn't necessarily want to be able to shoot stuff at, you know, extreme long range, but wants to have an effective tool to go out and, you know, extend their range beyond probably what they've ever shot before with a, you know, a fixed scope with cap turrets and, you know, so instead of, you know, having a 300-yard range and going, okay, well, I need to hold this high or whatever, they can range something and it lights up in the reticle and they know where to hold. And I think it helps those guys be more ethical in making those shots as well. Gotcha. Without having to get into the, you know, the details of, you know, ballistics and, you know, ballistic coefficients and, you know, temperature and, you know, all those factors that go into.
Did you find it accurate?
I did. I had to tune my system a little bit. I mean, I think there was like a 50 foot per second swing I had to make in my velocity or whatever, but it was, you know, that could have been chronograph error or whatever.
Gotcha.
But once I did that, it was, you know, really good out to, I think we tested all the way out to the limit of the system, which was about 800 yards.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
So, and I was ringing steel no problem at 800. And everywhere in between.
How is the range? Have you ever used a 2400?
Yeah, oh yeah.
How is the range finder compared to that?
Super fast, and it would range out to nearly the same range. I've ranged out to 3,200 yards with my 2400, and I don't think I've ever tried to range that far with my BDX, but it would range, you know, into the probably the high teens, you know, 1,800 yards or whatever, no problem. You know, I haven't actually used it that much. I took it on a hunt. Mm-hmm. I tested it, you know, out to 800, and it worked great, you know.
It's a cool idea.
No, it's really cool. Really cool.
We saw it at the NRA show, and I was like, wow. That I know it has to – is it – do you know if it's illegal in any states? Because I know that was some of the issues.
So I looked into that a fair bit, and actually the hunt that I went on was in Colorado with the SIG folks.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, their initial research and their attorneys said that in their opinion, it was 50-state legal.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, Idaho – is the only state that I've heard that's like, yeah, I don't know about that. So that's a little bit up in the air still.
That was the one I was actually wondering about, is the state we live
in. Idaho's always the stingiest, you know.
Yeah. We got those old damn commissioners, and they're the last ones with the 65% let off and the arrow weight and all that.
You had to have 400 grains. You got to have 65% let off. And I'm kicking Jaeger out. She's too loud.
Oh, Jaeger, poor baby. Aww. Darren's kicking his dog out.
All done.
The Velociraptor.
Yeah, she's just so excited to have some real hunting celebrities in the house.
Where are they? We haven't seen anybody else.
Must be that one guy that shot that big ass deer up there.
You guys must have rolled around in an elk or something before you came over. She was wound up.
She was at this elk pisses a cone.
Yeah, just right behind the
gets me all excited.
There was something I was smelling.
Yep.
No.
It's probably the sweatshirt, because he wears like the same sweatshirt for about three weeks straight.
I washed this one a month ago. It's good.
Oh, okay.
She can still smell it.
Yeah. She's got the nose, remember?
It's the nose.
Could be the hat. Who knows?
But, Idaho seems to be the last. Which is good. I mean, our muzzleloader are, you know, what muzzleloaders should be.
Yeah.
But I mean, I agree with some of that, but some of that you're like, what's the difference between that and taking out a Night Force with a 300 Ultra? You're going to be able to outdo that SIG any day of the week, you know, if you know what you're doing.
Right.
And I
wouldn't be surprised if it's, you know, all new technologies are vetted, you know, in the game agencies, you know, when something totally new or groundbreaking comes out, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a handful of states that are like, no, that's not what we had in mind, you know, because lighted reticles are legal in Idaho. And that's essentially all that the scope is. The difference is that the rangefinder sends a solution to the scope, and then it lights up the stadia in there that corresponds to your elevation hold. So, in theory, all that the scope is a lighted reticle. Mm-hmm. It doesn't do anything, but the rangefinder sends it something. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's some debate there. Whether it will be or will not be allowed in Idaho or other states is hard to say, but at you know, first blush, their take was that it was 50-state legal.
I got kind of a curveball question for you, but since you've kind of been on both sides of the fence, you're a big-time bow hunter, getting more into the long-range rifle side, ethics wise, I know it's a tough question, but what do you think about long range hunting? Not only just on rifle side, but long range bow hunting is coming around too.
Oh man, I think long range bow hunting has been there arguably longer than long range rifles. We've been dialing sights and stuff before that was really a thing in rifles. I mean, it's always been a thing, but we had movable sights with down to the yard, gradations on them for a long time in archery. And I think it's been almost 20 years that I've been using, that type of sight for archery. So it's been around, and I think it gets abused on both sides. But it comes down to the individual shooter, what my sight picture looks like at, X range is not what your sight picture looks like. It's not what the next guy's sight picture looks like, and the way that you prepare, to make those shots is not the same person to person. So there's no, it wouldn't be fair to say that, it's illegal to take a shot over 70 yards because my 70 yard shot is not what the next guy's is. And,
absolutely.
And conditions, there's times when I'll pass a shot at 40 yards, when maybe the next time I'd be more than happy to send one at 70 yards with a bow. Same thing needs to go for a rifle shot, I mean, there's wind conditions and a lot of stuff that goes into it. And I think ethically, you just have to learn, what your limits are and make ethical decisions when it's time.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's fair. Last year, I didn't take a 550-yard shot on a deer because the wind was blowing 20. I couldn't figure out what the wind was doing.
Right.
And even people say, well, 550 yards may or may not be long range to you, but I knew that on a deer that I don't think I knew for sure I could put it in the vitals at 550 yards. So I didn't take the shot.
20 years ago, people would have shit if you told them you shot something at 550 yards. Right. And there's still probably 80% of people today that would be like, 550 yards, you out of your mind.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, to a person that shoots long range rifle stuff all the time, 550 yards seems like a relatively easy shot, but it depends on the conditions. I passed up a 560 yard shot on a sheep this year because, it was getting lower light. And I knew that if I made a questionable shot, I might never see or missed. I might never see that ram again.
But in your mind, this is what I always go to, is you probably 90-plus percentile shot, you'd have made that shot.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, and that's what I... But you still chose not to take it.
I still chose not to take it because light was getting low. There was a few trees in the foreground, and I just wasn't confident that my bullet would necessarily clear those. And if I got a deflection and hit the ram bad or missed him completely... I knew that was a bad situation. So you just have to make really sound judgment calls because if, you end up in a situation where you wound something or miss out on an opportunity of a lifetime, that was the second to last day of my hunt. I was getting down to the wire and it would have been real easy to be like, that sheep might not be there tomorrow. This might be my only chance. I need to shoot now. But you have to weigh those choices up and make a smart decision. In this case, it worked out that I waited and didn't take the shot, came off the mountain, worked way harder than I would have had to if I had made that shot at that time.
Right.
But, two more times up the mountain and it worked out. But
yeah, and I didn't coin this thing and I just heard it several times is, you don't practice to know you can make the shot. You practice to know when not to take the shot. And I think that rings true most times.
Yeah. That reminds me of a saying that I heard at one point in time and really hit home is like the difference between a pro in a sport or an amateur in a sport is amateur practices until they can make a shot. A pro practices until he can't miss a shot.
Yeah.
And I think you have to take that mentality into a hunting situation. If you feel like you can't miss a shot, that's probably a shot that you you know, should feel confident and you should have no regrets in taking. But if it's a 50-50, you know, if you feel like you're 50-50 in a shot, you have no business taking that shot on a live animal. Absolutely. You know?
Yeah. You should be shocked you missed. Like, absolutely.
Yeah. Shocked. If you miss, and misses happen, you know, stuff happens in hunting. But, and if you're taking a shot that's questionable to begin with, then, you know, it's going to happen a lot. But, you know, if you feel like you're 100% on the shot and something happens, well, you know, at least you did all the prep and had confidence in your ammo and everything else going into it and had tested it in the field and felt like, I did everything in my power. Mm-hmm. You know, this should have happened. That, and a miss could happen at 100 yards. It can happen at 50 yards. It can happen at 500 yards. You know, absolutely. Even under good conditions. So.
Yeah, I passed the rifle off to you this year on an 80 yard shot.
Yeah, it's kind of reversed. She's not. Tanya can lay down and put down some great suppressive fire from military speed in the prone. I mean, she's going to kill you if she can get in the prone. But these elk were walking fast through the trees, kind of feeding, and there was a nice bull I wanted to shoot, and I told her to shoot it, and she's like, I don't feel comfortable. So she handed it to me, and it was an 80-yard shot through the trees, but it tells me we need to work on Tanya's offhand shooting.
Yeah, great choice. I mean, yeah, that's a good...
We both had tags, by the way, just in case you're wondering.
Yeah,
no. I was like, I don't feel good about this shot, and I was like, you can take it if you want it, and he did. And of course, he's a great offhand shot, so he shot it with no problem. And then later that day, I shot one at what 7:15. So
yeah, most people would be like, well, that's a way tougher shot,
but it was
to
not.
Anybody that knows,
right.
Mean, offhand shooting is difficult.
It's super difficult.
Maybe one thing that I've kind of taken from the archery side that maybe helped me in the, like the NRL 22 shoots is offhand shooting is kind of similar to shooting a bow.
Wow, absolutely.
I naturally hold fairly steady. You know, anybody can shoot off a bipod or a bench or whatever and hold pretty good, but offhand is a little different. Everybody's got some natural wobble or whatever. And,
mm-hmm.
But, and shooting a moving target offhand, that's, you know, that's pretty high level stuff. And if you've shot rifles your entire life and, you know, shot jackrabbits and whistle pigs and, you know, squirrels and everything else, then it comes natural to you. But to a new shooter, coming off a bipod to offhand is, you know, that's a big deal.
Oh, for sure. I was like, well, I felt like it, most anybody could have done that, taken the shot that I took, because I mean, I was steady and I had, you know, I mean, I was laying prone, but his shot to me like blew my mind.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. When she lined up, I had no doubts the elk was in trouble.
Right. Yeah. Because at that point it comes down to, you know, making a smooth trigger pull and knowing your rifle and your ballistics. The math part, the physics, that doesn't change. Right. Science doesn't lie. You know, that part's going to repeat.
There's no voodoo there.
There's no voodoo there. Yeah. So I think there's you know, the side of the hunting argument that's anti-long range probably maybe doesn't believe in the science or understand that, you know, that part's relatively easy. And relatively static. Yes, there's variables, wind and various things, and that's where, you know, you as the shooter have to make sound decisions. But there's times when a 500-yard shot is way easier than a 100-yard shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I'd be way more comfortable shooting an animal standing still in a low or no wind situation off a bipod at 500 yards than I would be at an animal walking at 100 yards.
Absolutely.
That 95% of the hunting public would take a shot at it.
Yeah.
I think that's key there, because people argue that have jump shot whitetail or jump even deer or elk underneath 100 yards that running through that timber is a very tough shot. And they'll argue a 500 or 600 yards, low wind, nice condition shot is unethical, where I think for some guys that don't practice or haven't done it, that under 100-yard shot with that deer elk full blast is an unethical
shot. Way tougher, way more unpredictable. Okay. because anytime something's moving, especially if you've got brush and stuff, you have chances for deflection or, you know, anything can happen. You know, change direction.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think it just comes down to lack of experience in the topic, because if those people that think a 500-yard shot is unethical, chances are they probably haven't tried it with the right weapon and, you know, had some education behind it, because if they're true shooters, I mean, like you said, it's just science, basically. Yeah. I just feel like it's lack of understanding. Yeah. And not saying that they have to agree with it, but at least if I feel like if they had tried it, or, you know, like made an attempt to understand more, then I don't think it would be such an open and shut case. Mm-hmm. But that's just my opinion. And I think that's where a lot of issues come about in life, is that if people don't take the time to understand it and educate themselves about a topic, then it's like fear takes over, and then they just shut it down because they don't understand it enough to know whether they truly disagree with it or not.
Yeah. But
on that note, what, like a 100-yard bow shot, what do you equivalent, you know, or what's the equal on rifle shot to you?
You can just multiply it by 10. That's a 1,000-yard shot.
So 80 be 800.
Yeah, the only difference with an archery shot is it's not quite like an offhand rifle shot, but it's not that far from it. And I think people tend to, I don't know, that's a long shot, but I hear quite a few people taking them and being successful at that range. And I know there's a lot of those people that probably have no business taking those shots. But, you know, 100 yards is a really long ways. Have to have really good conditions. And then, even then, it comes down to, you know, if I'm taking a shot that's on the outer end of my range, and I pull back and my sight picture doesn't look 100%, that shot's not getting taken. I've let down at 35 yards because my shot didn't, you know, my archery sight picture didn't look 100% to me. And that comes down to, you know, again, that judgment call for the shooter. They need to make good decisions in those situations. But for the most part, you know, guys probably shouldn't be shooting over 100. And, you know, 70 to 100 is getting pretty long. You know, in certain situations, that might be okay. A wounded animal that you've already hit, you know, I'll always send another arrow. Because if you've already hit them, you know, send one. You never know.
You're all in then.
Yeah. You're all in. You know, finish the job. Make every effort to.
Right. That's why I like having guys like you on, because you've been on both sides of the fence. You're not just... Too often you have a rifle hunter or a bow hunter speaking for both sides or talking about both sides. You've been bound down both roads, and you know you know the outcomes, I guess I should say.
Yep. Yeah. No, it's been kind of it's been fun to kind of compare that in my mind, you know, as I've been going through the learning curve, you know, on the rifle side, and just make those comparisons mentally and be like, wow, this, you know, here's my hit percentage, or here's where I feel 100% confident, you know, and for me, you know, 500 yards is off a good solid rest. That is 100% shot for me with the rifle, you know, on a big game animal. I feel like that's a range I cannot miss at, you know, unless something goes haywire.
Right.
So there, you know, when I was, before I got into long range shooting, you know, that seemed like a forever, right. You know, 500 yards, Jesus, that's a long ways, you know.
But that now might as well be like, a mile.
Yeah. You know, now I've made first round hits at 1,600 yards with a 243 caliber, you know.
Yeah, I try to tell people, they're outside of the wind, there's not a lot of voodoo if you do your
part. There really isn't. You know, you've got a solid rest, and there's situations where you can read the wind well enough with mirage and different stuff to where even a long shot, like 1,000 yards, feels like 100% shot. Correct. You know, depending on target size and whatnot. I mean, in tournament situations or, you know, PRS match situations where I feel super confident with some of the long range situations because I can see the wind so well with different things going on and everything agrees and you're like, you know, for sure that is a 1 mil hold and you know, you can bracket that within a certain range and you know, 9 times out of 10 that's a first round hit. And after that it's just repeat. Right. And you can ring that steel time after time after time. But other times you can't see mirage well or whatever and you're scratching your head going, I have no idea where this first one's going to go, so I'm going to really pay attention to my splash so that I can make a good correction on my second round. So, you know, again, it just comes down to each individual shot. And then, again, it's how you feel with it, you know, your hold in different situations because, you know, you're not always going to be on a perfect rest.
Right. You're going to have some wobble.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think that's the hardest thing for when she was getting into it is you're not always going to feel like you're 100% on target.
Yeah.
And you got to find out where your trigger break should come.
Yeah. Right. There's a lot of times when you can't get the back end of the rifle supported, you know, or maybe in the front end, you might be, you know, shooting off a single point and then you've got a lot of wobble to deal with. And then learning to shoot with that and understand, you know, how that impacts, you know, your grouping and your hit probability. That's most, you know, the biggest difference I think between rifle shooters and bow shooters practice way more. Right. Way more.
Yeah, it's cheaper.
Way cheaper. Yeah. And you know, you can go shoot your bow in your backyard.
Yeah.
There's guys that, you know, live on farms and whatnot that can go shoot, but most of the time they're going to shoot off the bench anyway. They're not shooting offhand and doing all that stuff that it takes to be, you know, proficient in, you know, so many facets of shooting. You know, archer guys are always shooting offhand. That's the only game in town. They could probably practice more up and downhill and, you know, various situations off their knees and stuff. But in general, archer shooters are probably better prepared to make long range shots than the average rifle hunter.
I'd agree with that.
Just because they shoot so much more.
And it seems like, and I don't want to say this and get hate mail for this, but it seems like archery hunters are more apt to do that. They're more into their sport. Because I think a lot of long-range rifle guys that I know, they'll shoot 3 or 4 or 5 times a year at range. Mm-hmm. But not like an archery guy that's out there at the 100-yard course 2, 3, 4, 5 times a week.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that you can do that. You can buy a 22 and you can shoot a whole lot of rounds that simulate long range. But I don't know if they're more fanatics about archery or...
It's easier because there's like more clubs. I don't know. Like it's more, in a lot of places, more conducive to that environment. Maybe I don't know.
I think so. You got a lot more access to a 100-yard archery range than you do a 1,000-yard rifle range for one.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's like you said. It's way cheaper to reload for archery because you just pull your arrows out of the target, stick them back in your quiver.
But it's even bigger than that because. When I go to hunt some places during archery season that are way back, you'll see on a ridge, I'll see 6 or 7 guys bow hunting. To where rifle hunting, I don't see them.
Yeah.
So they're more...
They're a little harder. It's a little harder core group.
And I don't want to say that as a whole, but...
It's because it's colder during rifle season.
I should say that as a whole, it seems like the bow hunters are maybe a little more hardcore, I guess. Or
they may be. I mean, I
just see bow hunters everywhere.
I think one of the other things that you have is that you can't pull your bow out of the closet after a year and go expect to make a, you know, medium to long range shot. You just can't do it. You can't rely on, oh, I'm going to have a good rest with a bow because you have to hold it in your hand, pull it back, hold steady and, you know, execute a shot. So those guys understand and know that they have to practice in order to be able to execute a shot at almost any range.
Right.
effectively. And rifle guys can say, well, I'm gonna be shooting off a bipod, I'll get some support under the rear, and at that point it becomes a trigger squeeze. And if it's in my range, then I don't have an issue making that shot. But a bow guy can be holding that sucker, and if he hasn't been shooting, you know, he's gonna be wobbling and shaking and, you know, whatever.
Right.
I think they know that they have to shoot, and right. I think a lot of rifle guys take it for granted.
Yeah,
I think you're onto something there.
Yeah,
and I
think it's more. I mean, I'll probably get hate mail for this, but I feel like it's more trendy to be a bow hunter. I mean, there's like much more on social media about, you know, people bow hunting, and guns are really right now being. I don't know that I want to even say a word for, like, just, it's like very negative connotation towards guns. And I don't know if that's playing into it. Yeah. I'm just spitballing here, but it seems like it to me.
And the demographic seems to be younger bow hunter wise than rifle hunter.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And I don't want to make excuses for people like not shooting and practicing for, I mean, at all. I don't want to make excuses for people, but it definitely does seem like there's more opportunities just because that's the way it is. I mean, neither here, neither there, but I don't know.
Don't know. All I know is you need to fucking practice.
Either sport.
Either sport.
Yeah. There's no substitute for practice and getting out there and trying to replicate hunting situations in your practice is so critical. And I think, regardless of your weapon, you need to do that.
Well, guns are intimidating. Like, if I was starting to hunt and I didn't have Ryan, I would have probably chosen a bow for my first weapon, because it is a lot less intimidating as a weapon for somebody that's never grown up around it, or, you know, I mean, so it is a lot more accessible in a lot of ways.
It's just easier.
As far as shooting, I'm not a bow hunter, or I don't have any experience with bows really, but for just Joe Schmo that doesn't have any, you know, anybody
there's a certain appeal to archery too. There's been, even in the movies lately, it just seems like archery's been glamorized, you know, on a lot of different levels. We saw it when I was working for Hoyt, and even right after I left for Hoyt, there was several movies that came out that brought in a ton of youth archers, you know, so they're, you know, whatever way, you know, Robin Hood or
Brave.
Yeah.
No, there's that
movie with the chick with the bow, then that they all try to kill each other.
Yeah. Hunger Games.
Yeah.
But all that stuff really boosted archery sales and brought a lot of youth into the sport.
Which
is awesome.
Yeah.
And shooting a bow is fun.
And it is super fun.
Yeah.
It is, I don't know if it's more fun, but it is, it's easier to enjoy, I guess, with various people. I mean, guns are loud, you know, they get hot.
They've kids. You know,
inherently more dangerous.
Inherently more dangerous, for sure. So, and I think in general, the public is more comfortable with bows.
Yeah.
You know? I would agree with that.
Yeah, and I don't want it to come out sounding like I'm like, oh, well, it's easier to bow hunt.
But bow hunting's not
easy. It's not at all.
It's just, I feel like just because of what it is, I mean, there's, like you said, it's easier to find a bow range than to go shoot a gun 1,000 yards. And
bow hunting's hard. Getting into bow shooting a bow is not hard.
Correct.
I think there's something to be said too for almost anything shot with a bow is a trophy. You know, it's a hell of a feat to kill an animal with a bow. You know, a decent buck.
Absolutely.
Or damn near any bull, you know, that's a pretty big deal. And I think people perceive that as a lot more of an accomplishment than, you know, the same feat with a rifle.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'll tell you firsthand that I get a way bigger adrenaline rush out of doing it with a bow than I do with a rifle at almost any range. Mm. So that's just maybe because I don't know, you know.
Right.
And it may be different for different people, and it may, you know, whatever. But there's definitely some serious adrenaline and reward that you get from being successful with a primitive weapon like that. And even though, Ryan, you think compound bows are...
They're cheating.
They're cheating compared to a longbow. I'm with you there. But
you still have to pull it back.
Oh, yeah.
There's no way around the movement.
You're in their bedroom at that point. Everything's more critical. Right. And so, yeah, archery's cool, but I've had a blast shooting guns lately, too. So.
I think they're both fun, and everybody should do both.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I'll go back, and I'll still swear to this. In northern Idaho, I would have a better luck shooting a big bull with a bow than with a rifle. Just because the season difference and the thickness.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's definitely...
There's been many occasions where I had my compound and missed out on an opportunity at a good bull and really thick stuff where I was like, man, if I would have had a stick bow.
Grip it and rip it.
Yeah, where I could have just smoothed back and let it fly, and, you know, at close range more instinctively. You know, there's something to be said for that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, switching gears a little bit so we can get through this, because Tanya keeps talking. I just can't stop her. But
I know.
You had I want to get into your sheep hunt, but I also want to get into you a lot of time on your sheep hunt behind the BTX and what your general thought about the BTX is.
That is the most amazing piece of glass I have ever looked through. There's no comparison in my mind. I've looked through, you know, the big doctors and the Kawas, and those are awesome. You know, I've looked through the Swarovski 80 millimeter spotting scopes, and there's nothing that compares to the BTX. The resolution is off the charts. There's no eye fatigue. I mean, I spent, you know, 10, 12, 14 hour days looking through the glass where I could see, you know, 5 to 7 miles, 360 degrees, and just wearing country out, and, you know, never had headaches or anything like that. And just being able to see into the shadows with, you know, more confidence in what you're seeing, more detail. It's amazing. It is incredible glass. I've got the 95 millimeter. Mm-hmm. So it's a big, you know, it's a big piece of glass, but it's really not that much heavier than the smaller, you know, front ends on those.
Mm-hmm.
And then the binocular side is relatively heavy, but worth every ounce. I mean, I drug that thing over, you know, well over 100 miles, probably 150 miles that I packed that thing over the season. And you leave no stone unturned when you've got one of those.
How far do you think you can actually, you know, consistently glass up animals at distance? How far?
It's really variable depending on the light.
Right.
You know, and the clarity of the air. I mean, I dealt with, there was a couple periods, you know, on my sheep hunt in the Frank Church in Idaho this year. We had a lot of smoke. But when the air is good, I don't know if there's a limit, man. I mean, as far as you can see, I mean, I spotted animals, you know, at least 10 miles this year in a couple occasions. And
that's
then
insane.
I felt like glassing at 4 to 5 miles was, you know, really effective. I mean, I glassed way farther than I had ever, you know, spent a lot of time glassing before. And it was a really powerful tool just to eliminate, you know, big chunks of country. And just really study, you know, trails and, you know, sign at range. I mean, I could see tracks and just detail that was amazing.
Did you have the ME adapter by chance?
Uh-uh.
Yeah, because I don't know what, I can't, was it 30 power that the BTX is on the 95?
I want to say 35 on the 95
is it?
Millimeter.
I think it bounces to 45 with that ME adapter, a little puck in it.
Yeah.
I have one, but I haven't had much time behind it because I just got the BTX. But yeah. I wonder,
You know, I never felt like I needed more power with it, which was a crazy thing, because I thought, you know, when I spotted something, you know, maybe I'd be longing to be able to crank that power up and really judge stuff. But I felt like the resolution and just having both eyes working in tandem, I was picking out details so well that I never really felt myself needing more power with it. Mm-hmm. If anything, I would have liked to have been able to crank it down in some cases where I was glassing closer so I could, gotcha. So I had more field of view. And just be able to see a little more country, you know, at one point in time. But man, you can just burn some country down with those things. It's amazing.
Having two eyes is crazy. I mean, it is basically like taking 12s or 15s on the 35 level.
Yeah, really, really. Yeah, they're awesome. The only thing I'd recommend to people is put as much tripod under that thing as you can, because keeping it steady just, you know, really enhances your ability to, you know, pick up those details and small movements, you know, an ear flicker or something at 2 miles, and you will see it.
What were you using?
That glass is steady. I was using a Really Right Stuff tripod with their anvil head on it.
Oh, big boy.
Yeah. Yeah. But that tripod is unbelievably stable, and it's almost as light as my lightest backpacking tripod. I mean, the whole thing probably weighs about 5 pounds, but just the stability of that thing, and then having the versatility to be able to clamp your rifle in it and hold that sucker rock solid and be able to make a really effective shot at 500 yards in essentially an offhand situation.
Right.
You know, where you had to be maybe standing up and set a rifle on the tripod, or just having the flexibility to, you know, create a super long bipod out of it in that situation, and being able to use it as a shooting tool or as a rear rest. The flexibility that a tripod like that offers you is well worth, you know, maybe the extra pound or pound and a half, 2 pounds, whatever, over a really lightweight, you know, 3 pound tripod or something like that. Way worth the extra poundage.
Yeah, you can't look at it just as your tripod for optics. No. It's versatility.
Yeah, versatility is awesome with those. The Really Right Stuff are super expensive, but they're just lighter, and those guys stand by their stuff, you know.
They're so solid.
So solid. Good, yeah.
And you look at them, you think they'd weigh about 50 pounds.
They look heavy, and you pick one up the first time, you're like, are you kidding me? You see a guy, you know, stand on one, a 200-pound guy, hang off the bottom one and bounce on it, and, you know. Try that with your backpack and tripod, you know.
No thanks.
Yeah.
So I might be a little more than 200 pounds.
Maybe.
Just 202.
201.
Yeah. 201.
Let's get into your sheep hunt. You obviously drew an Idaho sheep hunt, sheep tag.
After 12 or 15 years, finally drew.
12 or 15 years, you got it in the nice, easy Frank Church area.
Super easy, yeah.
How many days scouting? How many days actually hunting?
It was probably, I'm going to just round off, about 12 to 14 days of scouting, and then about 20 days actually hunting. So
in the scouting, how many actual sheep drummed up?
We saw quite a few sheep scouting, but I never saw a single shooter ram.
Really?
Not one.
Oh, how'd that weigh on you going in the first day? That would be.
That was a little unnerving, you know, because we covered a lot of ground and did a lot of long backpacking trips into some really good country that people had told us that were going to produce sheep. You know, like, hey, there's going to be rams in here. And we went in there and we glassed our asses off and we scouted hard and, you know, worked our guts out. And I was just thinking, man, what is going on? So it was a little unnerving. The other thing that may have limited some of our effectiveness during the scouting time from July to the end of August was there was a bunch of forest fires that closed off some access that we had.
And probably the visibility.
Yeah, and the visibility was tough on at least one of our scouting trips in there, where we did a really long backpacking trip and into some country where we thought we'd be able to glass for miles and miles. That was one of the trips we got smoked out on pretty bad, and that was really disappointing. But yeah, it's hunting the Frank Church is a mental game. You got to be mentally tough, because you can go in there for 5 days at a time, and it's possible you might not see a big game animal on that entire trip.
Do you think that's from lack of habitat or wolves, or what do you think that's from?
I've thought about that a lot, and I honestly don't have an answer. I think it's probably a combination of a lot of different factors. The habitat appears to be intact. You know, there's been a ton of big burns and stuff back there that, you know, in most cases makes good big game habitat.
Absolutely.
But, you know, I don't know. There's obviously some predation issues that, you know, have had major impacts on big game populations back there. I don't know if there's maybe some management issues that factor into things too. If they miss something and some populations got to a tipping point, you know, if there's been some disease issues or whatever, but there's not very many elk in a lot of that country, and there's not very many deer in a lot of that country. I saw more black bears than I saw rams.
And historically, there has been good populations in there.
Yeah.
Remember what I've read.
And we had a really tough winter 2 years ago that may have had a big impact on the deer, may have had a pretty big impact on the sheep. I don't know that I would say that, you know, winters don't typically impact elk herds that much.
I'd agree.
Especially when they can get down to, you know, the middle fork of the salmon and in winter at elevations around 4,000 feet and even lower. So you wouldn't think that, you know, but they were saying snow levels were at like 4 feet of snow down in those areas during that bad winter we had 2 years ago. That would have been, 2016,
yep.
I think. So that winter was severe. One of the, you know, most prolific sheep outfitters in that area told me that the big older age class rams really took a hit. He actually moved out of the unit 27 that I hunted. He moved out of there and started hunting a different unit right after that. So...
So those winters weren't just tolls on deer and elk or deer so much. It was the sheep and the goats took a little bit of brunt of that.
Yeah, I don't know about the goats. I saw some good goats.
Did you?
Yeah, I saw a lot of mountain goats. Seem to be doing well.
I don't know. I don't know anything about
goats. Goats are hardy bastards.
I'd imagine.
And, you know, sheep are tough animals too, but I think when I took my ram into fish and game, my ram was 9.5. Shit, I don't even remember now. 8.5, I think. But they said that the growth rings indicated that he had been sick for at least 2 years in some of his prime growth years. So he would have typically been a much better ram, but he had been pretty ill at some point. And a couple of his growth rings were really tight where they should have been, you know, really exaggerated compared to where they are.
Huh.
So it's hard to say, you know, there's a lot of factors that can impact, you know, game density and different stuff, but it's, you know, it's disappointing that, you know, one of the largest wilderness areas, protected, you know, areas and whatnot in the lower 48 is so devoid of game right now. And I hope it bounces back soon, but. You know, I don't know what the answer is.
And it's not like you spent 3 days in there. How many days did you end up spending in there?
33 to 35 days by kind of our rough figuring. So, I mean, over a month.
So that gives you a pretty good idea.
It's not like we were jacking around in there. We were covering it, working.
You spent some, you walked some miles
in there. Yeah. Yeah, we did, by conservative estimates, over 180 miles with a heavy backpack on, and then, you know, moving out from there to glass and whatnot, cover country. So 180 miles of just backpacking and then, you know, hunting from there, and over 100,000 vertical feet of climbed.
The picture you had of you and your, what was your buddy's name?
Kurt.
You guys were down, the picture you had on Instagram, you could tell you guys were putting some miles on. You guys looked like you'd put some miles on.
We were smoked at the end of that day. Yeah, that was tough, man. His ram and killing that ram and getting him out was probably the toughest hunting experience of my life. It was intense. I mean, we spent the night on the mountain with nothing, you know, and it was over 4,000 vertical foot, you know, up and down in some wicked country. Something we knew that we should not attempt to get out in the dark. You know, it was that treacherous. And just, you know, the physical demands of doing that with, you know, boned out meat and ram horns. And, you know, even your rifle becomes a burden at that point when you're coming out. That extra 10 pounds it's pretty significant, you know, when you're tapped out and low on food. And, you know, we could have planned a little better for that hunt. But when you get to a certain point on the mountain and you're like, you know, this is way more than we had planned to do, but the sheep are maybe just right there. And you just keep pushing and keep pushing each other. I don't think either of us could have done that hunt without the other one. You know, Kurt was definitely instrumental in me being able to harvest my ram. And I felt like, I really helped push him a little bit beyond, you know, well beyond what he probably would have been comfortable doing by himself on his ram. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but we've been hunting together for 25 years or whatever. And, you know, when you're on a sheep hunt in some of the toughest country in the lower 48, you need somebody that you can really trust know that, you know, you're both looking out for each other and going to be there no matter what happens. And that pushed us both to our limits.
And committed to the hunt.
Yeah. You know, we killed his ram probably on, I think it was the third or fourth day of the season. And he was there with me for another 20 days. And I never, any time I was ready to go, he was there. He was, you know, putting work on old, you know. I can't say enough about, you know, how dedicated he was to my success. That was awesome. Most guys, I mean, I even look at if it was him that had been that long, would I have been able to be as dedicated to him as he was to me? And it was awesome. He made that hunt for me.
Yeah, because he had no dog in the fight.
He had no dog in the fight, you know, but, you know, we've been there for each other in a lot of situations, and he stuck it out, man.
That says a lot.
Well, and you always hear horror stories and have probably experienced them about, you know, if there's a couple of you hunting, once somebody gets something, it's like they pop smoke and they're done. And
I've had it happen, and it's
a bummer.
It leaves, you know, a sour taste in your mouth. But,
right.
You know, that's, you know, when you get a good hunting partner, take care of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and on the just the hiking part, it's not that first or second or third day. It's every day after that you have to put it forth. Mm-hmm. And not having a dog in the fight, that really says something.
And when you're not feeling good and it's just, you know, it's looking like it's just not going to happen, but you just stick it out and keep grinding. And having somebody there with you that's willing to go when you are, you know. Because if he wouldn't, you know, it was after the 30th day or whatever that you've been up there grinding, you know, trying to find a ram, or, you know, I missed a ram, you know, I'm probably like day 25 or day 26 or 7, whatever, whenever that happened, would have been pretty easy for him to go, you know, he had his chance.
Right. Yeah.
I stuck with him till he got his chance, but no, he stuck it out for the 3,000 foot climb down after that, which was almost 10 miles to the truck. And then, you know, whatever 10 more days of hunting after that, right. He was right there, ready to go and see it through. He wasn't going to let me fail.
Well, I think it's probably harder to find a good hunting partner than it is a spouse, because there's a lot more suck in the hunting season sometimes than there is good.
I'm glad you said that.
I'm not lying. It's true. I mean, because you're not getting all the benefits in hunting as you are in marriage sometimes. I mean,
that's true. No,
I would assume not. Tough. But
that's funny. Everybody talks the physical, mental side, but what was kind of going through your head mentally after you missed that sheep?
It was really difficult at first. I was just crushed because I thought it might be my only opportunity. And I had worked so hard up to that point, you know, that was at the end of a, 25, 30 mile backpack trip. We'd been up there for, I think, 8 days on that one. Mm. We were on our way out, spotted a ram. I headed way back up into where we had just come out of. Made a really good stock. Did everything, perfect. Had my rifle dialed. And the one thing that I failed to do was seal up my barrel really well. And we had a bunch of snow and sleet and hail and rain that day, and my barrel got wet on the inside, and I made a really good shot, from my experience and just competitive shooting, and I know what the difference is between a a really good shot that I have confidence that's going to hit, and this was a 500 yard shot, which some people think's far, but that was my 100% range, and I made a conscientious effort to get to that spot and found a really good position where I had 100% rest, where my crosshairs weren't moving. Was able to make a really good squeeze, and the rifle went boom, and the sheep ran off, and I found them as they ran across the hillside, and all five rams were still there. And I was absolutely shocked that he didn't just fold up at the crack of the rifle. Even went, all the way down in that basin, even though we were on our way out. It was our last day. I ended up actually taking an extra day off work when I was supposed to be back, just because by the time we went down there, checked for blood, really did our due diligence to do the tracking job, make sure I didn't hit him and that another ram didn't pop up. It was a pretty big blow.
I bet.
And I wondered for the next, 12 or 13 days if that was going to be, the one and only opportunity. But in the end, I came back to the fact that I had done everything right that I could, other than, that one thing of sealing up my barrel well. And I went and tested that after the fact. I taped up my barrel with electrical tape and shot it with my barrel with tape on it to make sure that, hey, that doesn't affect my point of impact. And you can bet I had electrical tape with me the rest of my hunt, because I had my barrel covered during that hunt, and the balloon that I had on there got ripped off at some point, and I didn't have a couple extras with me.
Right.
So that was my own fault. But I was just really hoping that wasn't going to be the one thing that did me in and, was going to be the end of my sheep season. So,
just a tip, unlubed condoms are way tougher.
Yeah. Yeah.
So fast forward, you go to the second to the last day of the season, right?
Yep.
And how did that go down?
So we had spotted a ram the night before. We talked about earlier, I made a stalk on him, got to 560 yards. It was just getting dark enough to where I couldn't be sure that I had a clear line of sight with some of the branches and stuff that he was moving through. I didn't feel comfortable taking the shot in the lower light situation. So I bailed off the mountain, went up the next morning. My buddy was across the canyon.
On that note, though, this little backstory you told us earlier, you passed up that shot knowing that those sheep move a lot and you may not get that second chance.
I knew it was a pretty big risk, especially with only 2 days left in the season. And, you know, when sheep move in that country and you're camped 4,000 feet below, it's not like you can just, you know, go down the road a little ways and get a different angle, or go up the road and get a different angle, or go around the other side of the mountain and get a different angle. It's a freaking 3-day hike in some cases to get a different angle. So I knew it was a big risk, but I wasn't willing to, you know, screw up an opportunity or take a chance wounding a ram. So made the choice to come off the hill that night and not squeeze the trigger. And, the next morning, got up into that basin, basically at daylight, hiked up in the dark, and lo and behold, they were gone. And, of course, you're second-guessing yourself, like, damn it, I probably could have made that shot, you know, but don't panic. So, shortly after daylight, I got pinned down by 2 ewes and a lamb that moved into the basin. I couldn't get around. My buddy's across the canyon glassing for me, and he hadn't seen anything. So for all I knew, the sheep were gone. Finally, the two ewes and the lamb cleared the basin. I was able to get over and start peeking over into some of the other country that I couldn't see. And toward the end of the day, I finally found a ram way up high above where I'd been, above this little basin. I was able to top out over a peak. And when I topped out, I found 4 rams. And it was the same group that I'd seen the night before, because I recognized actually the ram that I shot. He's got a pretty good chunk out of his left horn. I was like, well, that's number 2. Where's the big guy? And I spent about 10 minutes looking for the other rams, but I couldn't see some country right below me, and the wind was starting to get a little bit squirrely. And I just made a decision that, you know, number 2 was, I would be way tickled with him, and it wasn't worth risking, you know, maybe some of the other sheep, those ewes were still up there somewhere too, and I, there was a ram somewhere. Could have been below me somewhere, and I was afraid of getting winded. So lined him up at 316 yards and made a really good shot and got her done.
It's a beautiful ram.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. It was an awesome hunt. One of the toughest things I've ever done, and really one of the, it's probably the most cherished trophy I've got on the wall, even though I took him with a rifle, and I went into the hunt wanting to bow hunt it, but the rifle was the right choice at that point in the game. I didn't want to burn that tag and risk, you know, waiting another 10 years until I had an opportunity. I mean, that's one of the reasons I've been putting in for sheep really consistently, was because it's a young man's game, and, you know, even at 45, I was like, I'm really glad I'm not going to have to do this 10 years from now, you know.
Right. And a trophy's an individual thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of that comes down to the experience. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, this ram at, you know, 160 or whatever he is, you know, as good as anything I have on my wall.
Absolutely. And you... And I can't, you know this, and you can't explain it to some non-hunters or people, that you look at things and then it instantly flashes back mm-hmm. to memories of what it took to get to that.
Yeah.
And you can't describe, I can't describe that to people, but the people that know.
Yeah. Yeah, it takes about 5 minutes for all the memories of that hunt, with the time and the effort and the sweat and the blood and the just... When you spend that much, when you put that much into a hunt, it just makes the whole thing that much more rewarding.
Absolutely. And it doesn't take much in those pictures to know you put a little effort into it, I can tell.
You look at the pictures of me 3 months before that hunt and pictures right after that hunt. It's pretty dramatic. I mean, I think I lost like 23, 24 pounds.
That's crazy. Incredible. That is crazy. And that's
a short window. I was training pretty hard as soon as I found out that I got the hunt, but it's no matter what you do, you're, you know, just putting in the work every day in that country and grinding. It's pretty amazing what you can do.
Oh, absolutely.
What you can transform your body into. I mean,
well, most people have no idea what 4,000 feet a day sounds like. Yeah. In a day.
Yeah. You can look at it on the map and think one thing, but until you do it,
Google's a lying bitch.
Oh, yeah.
Well, if I didn't ask you this, people ask me, what rifle did you use on that hunt?
I actually used a 6.5 SOM, short action ultramag, Remington short action ultramag, with a 147 Hornady ELD match bullet, and it performed really well. That ram ran about maybe 10 yards and piled up. I was shooting sort of into the sun at the angle I was at. So I had kind of some sun flare, and the recoil, I didn't get to see him drop. So I was a little concerned right after I shot, like, oh my, you know, there was rams going everywhere, and I knew that I couldn't just shoot another one because...
Yeah, they frown upon that.
Yeah, they frown upon that. And I couldn't tell which one was mine at that point. But I was pretty confident in the shot, and I hiked up there, and I can't tell you what it felt like when I saw him piled up.
I bet. You know, put your hands on him too.
Yeah, it was a 20-25 minute hike over there, and just kind of that thought of the first one I missed just put a little, you know, inkling of doubt in my mind, and I just wasn't 100% sure that. You know, I knew everything felt right. I knew I made a great shot again.
How close did you get before you saw him?
I was pretty much right when I topped out that peak. Well, I had seen a ram just over the peak. And so I knew when I got to the peak, I'd probably be able to see the rest of them. Because I knew it was probably the same group. And so I just basically, as soon as I topped that peak is where I shot from.
Gotcha.
Well, and that's a mental game all in itself, is after shooting and then that walk from where you're shooting to when you find the animal.
Yeah. It's like, yeah. As soon as I shot, I called my buddy on the radio and I was like, well, what did you see? Because I was hoping, he's like, oh, I saw him pile up. And because he and I and the ram were almost directly in line, but he's, you know, 2 miles away. And, he's like, well, I saw your muzzle blast, and I saw the sheep run, and then there was a little bit of scattered timber and some burnt stuff, and it was right at the limits of his view, so that just because he was so much lower than me, and he's looking steep uphill, and then I was on a little peak, and then there was a saddle, and then there was this other face where the rams were.
Gotcha.
And so a lot of his view was shielded, and he said, I saw the rams react, and... ran to the right, and then, you know, there were sheep everywhere, and I didn't see him fall.
Gotcha.
And so I'm on the radio, and I'm like, you know, please, don't let this happen again.
Right.
And I was like, all right, well, I'm going to go over there and track him and see. And I hiked over there, and I was heading up the ridge, and I had it all marked out where he was and everything, and I got just about... even with where he was at, I looked over and he had rolled down the hill about 30 yards and was piled up in the willows. And I got my buddy on the radio and I was like, hey man. He's like, yeah, what do you got? And I had to collect myself for a little while because I was about to lose it.
I bet.
Yeah.
It's a lot of emotion,
Pat.
Yeah. And I was like, we got him, buddy.
I bet. That's, yeah, like I said, none, you just can't explain that.
Yeah.
You can't.
Yeah.
And after that much, and you're, that much time, that many days, you're feeling like shit. You've lost a ton of weight. You know, like mentally, you're not just physically, but mentally, you're just like so beat down and your body's like tapping out like 20 days before that.
Yeah.
I mean, not to say hormones, but I'm sure we're going all crazy.
Yeah.
No, there's some low lows and some high highs in sheep hunting. I haven't been choked up too many times hunting, but twice during sheep season this year on both our rams.
I get
I'm
it.
Sure.
And you know that I say this all the time. People don't know how much I love elk or I love deer. But when you or you love sheep, it's I love them more than any anti-hunter can possibly imagine. Even though you take an animal's life.
Yeah.
I love them critters more than I love most humans.
Yeah. So. Yeah. People don't. It's, yeah. You just have to be a part of that, I think, to appreciate, you know, the respect that you gain for an animal after you've pursued them like that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, well done, beautiful ram. And
thanks, man.
Good thing you did it before you were too old to walk up there.
I'd have found a way, but it would have just hurt worse.
Got your walker out and just started.
No kidding.
What backpacks you guys use on those?
I was running my Exo Mountain Gear pack. This is the first year I've used that, and I was really impressed with just the flexibility of that pack, being able to use the kind of the meat shelf system in it, and it carries really well. Everything I really have no complaints about it. Worked really well for me. Kurt was running my old Kuyu 5200.
Yeah, did some pretty good loads in those coming out with the sheep and all your gear.
Yeah. On his ram, we had two other buddies with us, so. Coming down the mountain to camp was tougher with his ram because we ran out of food. We'd spent the night on the hill with nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we got to the bottom, we were smoked, dehydrated, tired, hungry. I bonked on his about... almost 1,000 feet from where we were going to hit the river and where our buddies were at camp. And he had a Jolly Rancher in his backpack. And I was literally starting to get faint and, you know,
losing it,
starting to cramp up, you know, and, pulled out a Jolly Rancher and that was just enough sugar to get my muscles working again and get me to the bottom. And then
isn't that amazing?
Our buddies crossed the river and came over to us and brought water and some food and stuff and got us enough. Cause our camp was only a quarter mile down river from where we hit it, but we were tapped, both of us. That was all we had.
It's amazing. One little piece of candy.
Just a little bit of sugar is all I needed to keep going. But coming out from our camp, we had a 7.5 mile backpack back to the truck from where we camped in the bottom. And I think I was about 115 pounds coming out with camp and half a ram and the head. The heads are heavy, man.
Yeah.
It's a long pull.
Those damn ram heads are heavy. And it was uphill all the way, but not super steep coming out on the creek bottom.
Yeah, they are way heavier than they look.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
And boots? Last question, boots.
We were both running Kenetrex. Yeah, just the Mountain Extremes.
Worked well for you. That's a lot of miles on them.
Yeah, I have two pairs. One of them... the soles are about gone, and those are my kind of my go-to pair, and I wore them for 3/4 of the hunt, but that last hunt, I wore my other pair that I've had resoled. They had better tread on them, not quite as waterproof as the other ones, but I knew because there was a little bit of snow up there, And as steep as it is, I just really felt like the integrity of the soil was more important than them being 100% waterproof for that last deal, because it was unbelievably treacherous. Stuff would, we'd had some snow and then it had froze and thawed, and so certain spots were muddy, other spots were frozen solid, you know, just that hard crust on the ground. Other spots were a little bit snowy, and it's 45 to 50 degree slopes. It's unbelievably, like, spooky when you stand on top of some of that stuff.
And like,
you're looking down and just going, if this goes bad, I don't know when I'm stopping.
Did you guys have trekking poles and stuff?
Yeah.
Did you have any problem with blisters at all?
No. I've never blistered in my Kenna treks, ever.
Nice.
And I know other guys that don't have as good a luck, but those boots really work well with my feet.
Yeah, boots are, our feet are, you got to find your
boot. Yeah, you got to find your boot. And the Kenna treks have always worked good for me. Can't complain there. But yeah, I used, XO's got some new trekking poles that they came out with. And I got some a couple of the first ones, and they worked really well. I did wear out the tip on one of them, lost the carbide, and actually the plastic is about halfway eroded from that one side.
Gotcha.
But they went through some shit on that hunt.
Those backcountry hunting ones?
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm just too fat for them, but I have one that does not want to stay up. And I've tried to get as tight as possible. But for the most part, they're light and they work.
Yeah, I have them slip a few times, but I think some of that's just because you twist them a little bit as you're going, and sometimes you can loosen them up.
That may be part
but
of
it. I was able to, you know, always get them back tightened up, but I did blow a carbide, and then by the time that we got back to the truck, like half of the plastic was gone off of that one. But
I like
they took some. I mean, there was a couple times where I was like, I can't believe I didn't just snap that in half, because you're hanging on for dear life in some situations, or you go down and that thing gets stuck in, you know, a log or whatever, and buries deep in the soil or just whatever the case. There was many times I was like, these damn things are tough.
They're lifesavers.
I was, I honestly, I don't know how you could hunt that country without trekking poles. Wouldn't even attempt it.
Got to have four-wheel drive.
Yeah, especially when you are an old fart like me and your knees start, you know, going south on you. And that extra security of having trekking poles to lean on is huge.
Well, that in a nutshell, it sounded like an epic year you won't forget.
Yeah, I was damn near all I did this year was sheep hunt, but I definitely don't regret that at all.
I wouldn't.
I mean,
when you're laying on your deathbed, you'll remember that.
Yeah, I'll never forget it. There's no question. It's not a hunt I would recommend to anybody, unless you're just looking for the most unbelievable challenge you'll ever have in your life. But if you want to go have fun hunting, that's probably not what I'd recommend.
But would you do it again?
I would, now that I've learned as much as I did on that one. I would definitely do it again. I'd definitely take any opportunity I can get to go sheep hunting. But I think there's a lot easier hunts for a guy to chase than to go think, you know, you're going to go have a great time hunting sheep in the Frank Church. Cause
nothing about that sounds fun.
One of the guys that I talked to that had hunted it before told me, he's like, sheep hunting is secondary fun. He's like, it is absolute misery while you're doing it. But when you look back on it, you'll always have, you know, fond, awesome memories. You know, so it's fun after the fact.
Secondary fun.
That's a good way to phrase that.
But while you're grinding out there, it's, you know, there's many times I can reflect on, and, you know, we had some, just backpacked through some gorgeous country and, you know, had a lot of good laughs, and, you know, it's always fun when you're spending time in that country, but there's a lot of stress and other stuff that comes with having a once-in-a-lifetime tag. And
absolutely.
And that country will humble the hardiest of men.
Well, thanks for sharing it.
Yeah, man.
Absolutely.
Where can people stalk you?
I am on Facebook at Darren_Cooper and at Darren Cooper on Instagram.
And you're writing for?
I will write for Western Hunter Magazine. So.
And we're going to steal you back for a few on Rockslide.
Let's hope so.
Thanks a lot, man. Thanks a lot, Darren.
Yeah, glad you guys could come by.